The Royal Adelphi Music Hall was the kind of place that made men forget their manners. Golden gaslight poured from chandeliers like captured sunlight, flooding the room in warm amber and deep shadow. Velvet curtains the color of crushed wine framed the stage. The air was thick with cigar smoke, expensive perfume, and the laughter of men who had nothing to lose and everything to spend. Private boxes lined the upper level, draped in silk and shadow, where gentlemen leaned forward on polished mahogany rails and watched the stage below with the particular hunger of men who had paid for the privilege. It was, by every measure, a beautiful room. But beauty in this world always had a price, and someone else was always the one paying it. Alexander Stirling, Duke of Ravenshaw, had not wanted to come. He had said so twice, once at the door of Pembroke's townhouse and once in the carriage, but Lord Sebastian Pembroke had the infuriating habit of hearing only what suited him, and Sir William Lockwood had smiled his easy smile and said the evening air would do Alexander good. 3 hours of parliamentary debate had left Alexander's patience threadbare. He had agreed simply to end the argument. Now he stood at the entrance of the upper gallery, his tall frame filling the archway, one gloved hand resting on the silver head of his cane. His evening coat was black and perfectly fitted. His jaw was set. His grey eyes swept the room with the cool, measuring gaze of a man who had learned long ago that most things in life were not worth the trouble of feeling. Society called Alexander Stirling the coldest duke in England. He had never corrected them. Sebastian was already leaning over the rail, pointing at something on the stage with boyish enthusiasm. William had flagged down a server and was ordering champagne for all three of them. Alexander moved toward the box with the slow, unhurried certainty of a man who knew the room would wait for him. It always did. He settled into his chair, accepted a glass he did not intend to drink, and turned his gaze toward the stage below. The act in progress was a comedy of some kind, men in absurd hats. The audience applauded on cue. Alexander watched without seeing. His mind was still in the parliamentary chamber, still running arguments, still counting votes. Then the music changed. It was a subtle shift at first, the tempo slowing, the melody dropping from bright and brassy to something lower, darker, more intimate. The comedy act retreated behind curtain. The audience stirred, men sat forward. Conversations hushed. A single spotlight burned to life at the center of the stage, and she stepped into it. Alexander's mind went quiet. Not gradually, not politely, all at once, as if someone had pressed a hand over the noise inside him and simply stopped it. The woman wore a gown the color of deep crimson, the silk catching the gaslight, so that she seemed to burn as she moved. Her dark hair was swept up with a single arrangement of dark feathers, a few soft strands escaping to frame a face that was, even after 7 years, even across a crowded music hall, even through a haze of disbelief, Pauline Hawthorne. Alexander did not move, he did not breathe. The champagne glass hung forgotten in his fingers. His heart, that organ he had spent 7 years convincing himself he no longer required, slammed against his ribs with the force of a verdict. She danced the way she had always done everything, with a grace that looked effortless, because she had worked so hard to make it so. Her movements were fluid and precise, each turn and extension perfectly timed to the music, her arms carving slow, deliberate shapes in the gilded air. The audience watched her the way men watched something rare and dangerous. Men in polished boots leaned forward from their private boxes. Men in the stalls raised their glasses. Men who had no business, even knowing her name, smiled as though her beauty was something they were entitled to receive. Alexander's grip tightened on the silver head of his cane. Sebastian said something beside him. He heard nothing. The room had narrowed to the width of a spotlight. The noise had fallen away. There was only Pauline, moving beneath the gaslight, her dark eyes sweeping the room with a practiced calm that broke Alexander apart, because he knew, it was not calm at all. He had stood close enough to her once, to know the difference between her stillness and her peace. That was not peace. That was armor, old, well-worn armor built from years of holding herself together in rooms that did not deserve her. A man in the box to Alexander's left, ruddy-faced, already deep in his second bottle, leaned across to his companion and said something low and careless about Pauline, something about the shape of her mouth, something about what a man might offer to see her smile in a more private setting. Alexander turned his head. He did not raise his voice. He did not reach for the man's collar. He did not do anything so crude as make a scene. He simply looked at the man. The smile died. The man set down his glass, turned to face the stage, and did not speak again for the remainder of the evening. Sebastian glanced at Alexander. William glanced at Alexander. Neither of them said a word. On the stage below, Pauline's eyes moved through the crowd in the automatic sweep of a performer who has learned to look without seeing, and then, in the way that impossible things sometimes happen, her gaze traveled up toward the private boxes. "And found him," she faltered. It was barely visible, a single missed beat. Her foot hesitating a fraction of a second before the next turn. Her breath catching just slightly, just enough that the feathers in her hair trembled. For one suspended moment, 7 years dissolved. She looked at him in the way she had once looked at him across a candlelit music room, with recognition, with longing, with something so raw that Alexander felt it land in his chest like a physical blow. Then her chin lifted, her spine straightened, her eyes locked onto his, and she kept dancing. Every movement that followed was a sentence. "Why did you believe them? Why did you never come? Look at what I survived while you stood still." Alexander could not move. He could not look away. His jealousy was not the clean, sharp kind that a man can examine and set aside. It was tangled, grief and rage and desire and guilt and a longing so old he had named it something else years ago, just to keep breathing. He watched men watch her and felt something in him contract into something dangerous and precise. She was the most beautiful thing in the room. She always had been. And these men were looking at her as though she were a performance put on for their benefit, as though her history and her pain and her survival were decorative features of a show they had bought tickets to see. When the music reached its final swell, Pauline held her last position with perfect stillness. Arms extended, head tilted, the gaslight painting her in gold, and the audience erupted. Then she fled. She was gone before the applause had properly begun, slipping behind the curtain with the swift, practiced motion of a woman who had learned to disappear quickly. Alexander was on his feet before he knew it. Sebastian said his name. William reached toward him. He was already moving. He crossed the gallery in long strides, descended the curved staircase with his cane, striking each step like a count, pressed through the crowded lower hall, past startled servers and velvet dividers, and out through a side door into the cold London night. Fog had settled over the street. Gas lamps burned in halos of pale orange light. The cobblestones were slick with an earlier rain, and the air smelled of smoke and whetstone and river wind. He saw her. A flash of crimson. At the end of the lane, she was running, her skirts gathered in one hand, her free arm out for balance on the uneven stones, her breath coming in visible clouds in the night air. She moved quickly, but Alexander's legs were longer, and his purpose was 7 years overdue. She turned down a narrow passage behind the theatre, then through a gate, then up a short flight of stairs to a door in a tired-looking building whose walls had once been white and were now the grey of old snow. She knocked the door open herself and lunged inside. Alexander reached the bottom of the stairs. He stood there for a moment, his breath controlled, his cane at his side, the fog drifting past him. Then he climbed the stairs. He knocked. Silence. He knocked again, Three measured strikes. The knock of a man who is accustomed to doors opening for him. A sound from within. A small voice. Footsteps. Light ones. Quick ones. The door opened, and Alexander looked down. A boy stood in the doorway, 7 years old, perhaps 8. Small but straight-backed, holding a leather-bound book against his chest with both hands, looking up at the man on the step with clear, steady gray eyes. Gray eyes. Alexander's own gray eyes looked back at him from the face of a child he had never met. The boy had his chin, his brow, the particular set of his jaw that appeared in 3 generations of Sterling family portraits. The boy looked at Alexander with the serious, unafraid gaze of a child who has learned not to flinch at the world. "Who are you?" the boy asked. Alexander's voice, when it came, was barely above a breath. "My name is Alexander," a movement behind the boy. Pauline appeared in the inner doorway, still in the crimson gown, her hair half undone, her face the color of cold marble. When she saw Alexander's face, and then saw where his eyes had gone, to the boy, to the boy's gray eyes, to the unmistakable Ravenshaw jaw on a child who stood in a rented room behind a music hall, she made a sound that was not quite a word. "No," she said, "it was not an answer, it was a plea." Alexander looked at his son for a long, silent moment, then he looked at Pauline, and the entire architecture of the last 7 years. The bitterness he had built, the contempt he had cultivated, the careful, elaborate construction of not caring, collapsed like a house of paper in rain. He had believed she left him. He had believed she betrayed him. He had spent 7 years hating a woman for a wound she had not given him. And she had spent those 7 years alone, raising his son in a room that smelled of tallow candles and old plaster, dancing beneath gaslight to keep the child fed. The boy looked between them with the serious attention of a child who understands more than adults wish children to. "Mama," he said quietly, "do you know this man?" Pauline's hand pressed against the doorframe. Her knuckles had gone white. Alexander answered before she could. "Yes," he said quietly. "She does. Hey, quick question, how are you feeling right now? Thank you so much for being here. It truly means everything. I am working toward 1,000 subscribers, and if this story of survival, secrets, and a love 7 years overdue is already pulling at your heart, please hit that subscribe button, smash the like, and drop a comment telling me where you are watching from. It helps more than you know. All right. Thank you. Now let's get back to what happens when the woman they forced out into the cold becomes the one the Duke cannot live without. 7 years before, the Lye Ravenshaw house rose from the Wiltshire countryside like a monument to everything England believed about itself. Marble staircases swept upward in symmetrical grandeur. Long galleries were hung with oil portraits of dead dukes, each face more imperious than the last. Crystal chandeliers hung in every formal room, cold and brilliant when unlit, blazing when the household entertained. The winter garden extended from the east wing in a long, graceful arc of glass and iron, and inside it, even in the coldest months, roses grew in careful arrangements behind heated glass. It was the most beautiful house Pauline Hawthorne had ever seen. It was also, she had understood within a week of arrival, a house that ran on the precise management of appearances. Pauline had come to Ravenshaw House as companion to Lady Violet Sterling, the youngest child of the Sterling family, a girl of 19 who had a quick mind, a generous heart, and the particular loneliness of a girl raised more by governesses than by her family. Pauline had been hired through a clergyman's recommendation. Her father, a clerk of modest learning and immodest debts, had died 2 years before, leaving her educated, refined, and utterly without resources. She spoke French, she read Latin, she played the pianoforte beautifully, she had excellent posture and impeccable grammar, and precisely nothing behind her but her own quality. Lady Violet adored her immediately. The rest of Ravenshaw House took longer. She was not a servant. She was not a guest. she occupied the uncertain middle ground of the companion. Invited to family meals, but seated at the foot of the table, included in morning calls but introduced last, permitted in every room, but never entirely belonging to any of them, the servants treated her with the respectful distance they might extend to someone they suspected might one day report them. The family's guests looked through her. Lady Margaret Stirling, Alexander's mother, a woman of extraordinary self-possession and opinions filed sharp as pins, watched her with the quiet, appraising gaze of a woman cataloguing possible risks. Alexander Stirling was, at that time, the Marquess of Ravenshaw, not yet Duke, not yet the feared, untouchable figure society would later call the coldest man in England. He was 30 years old, broad-shouldered and dark-haired, with the kind of presence that announced itself before he entered a room. He carried the weight of inheritance, the way men of his class learned to carry it, as if it were natural, as if the entirety of his person had been designed for exactly this purpose. His voice was low and even. He never repeated himself. He had the patience of a man who has never had to hurry, because the world rearranges itself to accommodate him. Pauline had been determined not to notice him. She had been in service to Lady Violet for 3 weeks, when she first played the pianoforte in the secret music room after dinner. The family was occupied elsewhere. Violet had asked her to play something light, and Pauline had played for nearly an hour, alone in the lamplight, because music was the one place in Ravenshaw House where she did not feel like a woman balanced on the edge of someone else's world. She did not hear the door. She was not aware of him until she lifted her hands from the keys and the last note faded into the warm air and she turned to find Alexander Stirling standing in the doorway. He was not watching her with the careless appreciation of a man who has wandered in by accident. He was watching her with complete serious attention, as if the piece she had just played had asked him a question he was still trying to answer. Their eyes met. Neither of them spoke. Pauline stood from the bench and curtsied, properly and quickly, and said she hoped she had not disturbed anyone. Alexander said, "Not at all. Please continue." She played for another half hour. He sat in the chair nearest the door, turned slightly away as though he were reading. There was a book open in his lap, but she felt his attention, on her the way one feels warmth from a fire without looking directly at the flame. After that, it became a quiet habit. 3 evenings a week, sometimes more. He would appear in the doorway, and she would continue playing, and the music would fill the space where conversation might have been awkward, where propriety insisted on silence, where they were both, separately and together, grateful for something that didn't require them to pretend. Their friendship, if it could be called that, grew in fragments. A book of poetry he left on the window seat in the east corridor, which she was certain had been left deliberately. An afternoon in the conservatory when rain came suddenly, and they were both trapped inside, and 2 hours passed in conversation about Roman history, before either of them seemed to notice the time. His hand closing over hers when she reached for a piece of sheet music that slipped from the stand, both of them going still for a moment too long before she stepped back. He began appearing in the winter garden on the mornings she walked there with Violet. Then he began appearing on the mornings she walked alone. Pauline was not a foolish woman. She understood what was happening. She also understood, with the precise, painful clarity of a woman who had learned not to rely on things she could not control, what it meant and what it could never mean. He was the heir to one of the oldest dukedoms in England. She was the daughter of a dead clerk. The arithmetic was not complicated, but Alexander did not seem to have any interest in arithmetic. One January morning, frost pressed against the winter garden glass from outside and roses bloomed inside the heated enclosure in shades of deep pink and ivory. Pauline had come early, while the house was still quiet, her wool shawl wrapped around her shoulders. She was examining one of the rose cuttings when she heard his footstep on the stone path behind her. She did not turn. She heard him remove one glove. She heard him approach until he was standing beside her. Then his bare hand reached forward and touched hers. Not her gloved hand, but the uncovered wrist where her glove had slipped back, and the warmth of his fingers against her cold skin was so sudden and so deliberate that she stopped breathing. "Everything in my life," Alexander said quietly, "has been arranged, planned, decided before I had an opinion to offer. This house, this title, my education, my obligations." He paused. "You are the first thing in my life that I have ever wanted entirely for myself." Pauline turned to look at him. His expression was the most unguarded she had ever seen it. "You are the Marquess of Ravenshaw," she said carefully. "Your wants are not entirely your own. I know. Then you understand why this." "I know," he said again, "and I intend to change it." She should have argued. She knew she should have argued. But standing in the winter garden with his bare hand wet warm against her wrist and the roses, opening around them, and the cold world pressing against the glass outside, Pauline Hawthorne did what she had been trying not to do since the first evening she played the pianoforte. She believed him. Their love grew with careful slowness and terrible depth. Secret evenings in the library, long after the household had retired. Glances across dining tables that lasted a fraction too long and were caught by no one. Or so they believed. Letters pressed into books. Her name in his voice, spoken differently than he spoke any other word. He kissed her for the first time in the conservatory on a February evening when the rain was so loud against the glass roof that the rest of the world might as well have not existed. It was not a reckless kiss. It was the kiss of a man who has thought about something for a very long time and is now certain. She stood with her hands pressed flat against the front of his waistcoat, and felt his heart move beneath her palms, and understood with terrible completeness that she had already lost the battle she had been fighting. He promised her marriage. He said it quietly, in the library, on a night when lamplight turned everything amber and the house had gone to sleep around them. He said he intended to speak to his father when the time was right. He said he would not hide her. He said she would stand beside him where every person in England could see her, and anyone who objected could find another duke to court. Pauline told him she loved him. She had never said it so clearly before. It came out simply and completely, without decoration, because it was the truest thing she knew, and she was too exhausted from trying to not feel it to dress it in anything else. He cupped her face in his hands and looked at her for a long moment. "Whatever happens," he said, "remember that I meant everything I said to you." She had not understood then why he framed it that way. She would understand later. March arrived cold and gray over Ravenshaw House. The old Duke's illness had been worsening since January, quietly at first, then with the rapid, unmistakable deterioration of a man whose body has made its decision. Doctors arrived at odd hours. The house curtained itself in preparation for grief before death had properly come. Lady Margaret moved through the corridors with the careful composure of a woman who has long rehearsed this particular sorrow. Alexander spent hours at his father's bedside, emerging only for meals he barely ate, moving through the house with the distracted, hollow expression of a man who is carrying more than he can set down. Pauline gave him space. She understood duty. She understood grief. She played the pianoforte less frequently, avoided the rooms where she might disturb, and poured her attention into Violet, who was frightened and tried to hide it. It was during those gray weeks that Pauline began to feel unwell. At first she attributed it to cold, then to poor sleep, then to the particular anxiety of a house in mourning. Then, on a Tuesday morning in late March, she sat on the edge of her bed after a bout of dizziness, so severe she had to grip the headboard, and she understood. The knowledge arrived not as a shock, but as a slow, terrible dawn. The kind of light that changes everything even as it reveals it. She was carrying Alexander's child. Her first feeling was joy, a sudden, involuntary bloom of something warm and overwhelming. Her second feeling, arriving immediately behind the first, like a shadow behind a candle, was terror. She spent the day in quiet calculation. She could tell him. She must tell him. The child was his, and she loved him. And he had promised her marriage, and surely, surely, a child would make the conversation that much more necessary, more urgent, more real. That evening she went to find him. Alexander had been with his father for hours. She knew the pattern. The doctors arrived at 6. The family gathered after 7. The sitting room outside the Duke's chamber would have a brief opening around 8:30, when the household shifted routines. She moved through the upper corridor toward the old Duke's suite. The house was hushed. A candle burned in a wall sconce. Her slippers made no sound on the carpet. The door to the chamber was ajar. She raised her hand to knock, and then she heard the old Duke's voice, weak but precise, each word placed with deliberate weight. "You must forget that girl." Pauline's hand fell. She stood perfectly still. "She is unsuitable," the old Duke continued. His breath was effortful, but the conviction in his voice was iron. A clerk's daughter with nothing behind her, it would be a stain. Not on you alone, on the Ravenshaw name, on every alliance this family has built, on your children and their children. You are not a young man who can afford the luxury of sentiment. Silence. "There are suitable women. Lady Beatrice Randolph has expressed interest through her father. The Randolphs are excellent family. It would secure the northern seats, strengthen father." Alexander's voice was quiet, tightly controlled. Pauline held her breath. "Say it. Say my name. Say you won't forget me. Say you choose me. Say it out loud where I can hear it and believe it, and hold it against everything that comes after." "We will speak of this later," Alexander said. "You must rest." Those 5 words, "we will speak of this later." To Alexander, she would understand only much later, only when it was far too late. It was delay. He was exhausted. His father was dying. He needed that night to end before he could fight the argument properly. To Pauline, standing in the corridor, with her hand against the wall and new life growing inside her, that no one in this house would welcome, those 5 words were a sentence, a verdict, a door closing. He did not refuse. He did not say her name. He did not choose her. She pressed her hand over her mouth and walked quickly back down the corridor. She did not run. Her legs were not reliable enough for running. She moved mechanically, one step then the next, until she reached the landing at the top of the east staircase. She was going to be sick. She gripped the banister and breathed in and out, in and out, in and out, then out, then a voice behind her, "Miss Hawthorne." She turned. Archibald Warren stood at the end of the hall. He was a man of 50, silver-haired and carefully dressed, with the sort of face that had been built to project trustworthiness. He had been the Sterling family's solicitor for 20 years. He spoke always in a calm, measured voice, as though every sentence had been drafted in advance and reviewed for errors. He looked at her now with the quiet attention of a man who has spent the last several minutes making a decision. "I think," he said pleasantly, "that we should have a conversation." They went to the small study at the end of the east wing. Archibald closed the door. He did not offer her a seat, but she sat anyway, because her legs had stopped being something she could rely on. He did not waste time. He told her he knew she was expecting. He had noticed. He said it with the detached precision of a doctor. The signs, the pallor, the mornings, the way she sat now with her hand pressed to her midsection, as though she were protecting something. He told her the child, if she remained, would become a problem that the Sterling family would be required to solve. He told her that problems of this kind were solved in ways that women without family and without legal standing typically did not like. He told her that a child born from her would create a scandal that could damage Alexander's political future. His inheritance, and his ability to make the alliances the family required. He told her all of this pleasantly, reasonably, as though he were explaining a minor administrative matter. Then he set an envelope on the desk. "This will provide for you," he said. "Sufficiently." Pauline looked at the envelope. "You want me to leave? I want the difficulty resolved before it becomes a crisis." "Yes. And if I refuse?" Archibald folded his hands. His expression did not change. "Women in your position," he said, "have very few choices when powerful men decide to take an interest in the problem they represent. Your child could be taken. The matter of paternity could become publicly contested in ways that are unpleasant for everyone involved, but most unpleasant for those without a name to shield them. I have known solicitors to move very quickly when a duke's estate requires them to." He let that sit in the air between them. "I am not asking you to vanish from the earth," he added. "I am asking you to go quietly. Take the money. Find a respectable situation elsewhere. Raise the child without the stigma that this house would attach to both of you if you stayed." Pauline sat in the chair for a long time. She thought about Alexander. She thought about his voice, saying, "We will speak of it later." She thought about Tult inside her. She thought about what it would mean for that child to be contested. Contested, claimed, and fought over in rooms full of men with lawyers and seals. She was 23 years old. She was alone. She had no family. She had no legal protection. She had education and grace and love, none of which mattered to any court in England. She picked up the envelope. Archibald nodded once. "I will leave a note for Lord Stirling explaining your reasons for departure," he said. Something gentle. He was already writing it. She understood then. He had already written it. She took the envelope and left the room. That night, the old Duke died. The great bell in the house tower struck twice. Servants hurried through corridors with black cloth for the mirrors. Lady Margaret knelt at the foot of the old man's bed. Violet pressed her face into her hands. In the chaos of first grief, in the confusion of a household turned upside down by death, a carriage arrived at the servants' entrance at 4:30 in the morning. Pauline descended the back stairs with a small case, and the coins from the envelope, and the child no one could see, but everyone already meant to. Control. At the foot of the rear steps, she turned and looked back at Ravenshaw House. Every window was dark. Every window was still. She turned into the fog and did not look back again. Alexander searched for her when the first terrible days of grief and obligation released him. Long enough to breathe, he found her room empty. A blue ribbon remained on the windowsill. Her sheet music was gone. The room looked like a room from which someone had been carefully erased. Archibald came to him that afternoon. He was sympathetic. He was gentle. He produced a note, neat, signed with Pauline's name, that spoke of another situation, a different life. A man she had known before, an actor, someone called John Holloway. He suggested the attachment had been longer than Alexander knew. Alexander read the note 3 times. He folded it. He set it on the desk. He stood in Pauline's empty room until the light through the window changed from grey morning to grey afternoon, and he held her blue ribbon in his fist until the silk was crushed and warm from his grip. He believed the lie, not because he was stupid, because grief had hollowed him out and left him with nothing but pride in the empty species, and pride always prefers a clean wound to an open question. It was easier. Not easier, nothing about it was easy, but less consuming, to believe she had chosen to leave than to believe she had been forced. The first made her faithless. The second made him helpless. And Alexander Stirling had no practice at helpless. He placed the ribbon in the drawer. He closed the drawer. He put on his coat. He became the Duke of Ravenshaw. And the Duke of Ravenshaw, as everyone would learn over the following years, had no heart worth speaking of. Edmund was born in the middle of October. The room Pauline had rented was on the 3rd floor of a lodging house on a narrow street in Southwark, and rain had leaked through the ceiling all summer and fixed nothing of itself when autumn came. The old midwife, who had been recommended by the woman in the room next door, arrived at midnight and stayed until morning. There was no family, no doctor sent by anyone, no word from anyone who knew Pauline's real name. There was a single candle, there was the sound of rain, there was Pauline's own voice, quiet and steady even when she was not steady at all, telling herself that this child was not coming into a ruined life, that she would not let it be a ruined life. Edmund Sterling Hawthorne arrived at dawn, small and red-faced and furious with existence, and Pauline held him against her chest and wept with a relief so absolute it left her hollow. He was hers, he was here, he had his father's grey eyes. She named him Edmund because it was strong and it was old, and it belonged to no one who had ever hurt her. She told herself she would survive. She spent the next 6 months discovering what survival actually required. The money Archibald had given her did not last as long as she had hoped. Rent consumed the first portion. The cost of a midwife and medicines for Edmund's first winter consumed the next. By the time Edmund was 6 months old, and Pauline was running out of things to sell, she had learned to do without sleeping through the night, without adequate food, and without allowing herself to think about warmth. She worked as a seamstress first. She was good with her hands. Her education had seen to that. And she found a dressmaker on Commercial Street who would send her piecework. She sat beside Edmund's cradle in the evenings and sewed by whatever light she could afford, her fingers aching from the needles, her back aching from the posture, her eyes straining in the dimness. The women who collected the finished work looked at her with the particular expression of women who have decided that someone else's poverty is a personal failing. Pauline kept her chin level and handed over the work when the dressmaker reduced what she paid per piece. A decision made quietly, without explanation, as such decisions always were. Pauline found work in a private supper room in Covent Garden. She carried trays. She smiled at men who spoke too freely and women who judged too quietly. She kept her expression pleasant and her mind somewhere else and came home to Edmund each night, smelling of other people's food. She was 24, then 25, then 26. Edmund grew. He was a bright, earnest, serious-faced child who asked questions the way other children asked for sweets. Constantly, hopefully, and with enormous patience for the answers, he learned to read by 4. By 6 he was working through whatever books Pauline could find at the second-hand sellers on Farringdon Road, sitting cross-legged on the floor with his brow furrowed, looking, in those moments, so precisely like his father that Pauline sometimes had to look away. She never told Edmund who his father was. She told him only that his father was a great man who did not know he existed. Edmund accepted this the way he accepted most things, seriously and without drama, and went back to his books. When the supper room, work became unpredictable. When the employer became difficult in ways that required Pauline to choose between her safety and her wages, she left. She heard about the Royal Adelphi Music Hall from a woman named Clara who worked in the lodging house laundry. The pay was better than anything else she had found. The manager, a man named Mr. Gideon Forsyth, wanted women who could carry themselves with elegance and learn choreography quickly. Pauline could do both. She stood in the back corridor of the music hall on a Tuesday afternoon and told herself she was doing what her son needed her to do, and that no woman should be ashamed of feeding her child, and that the people who would look down on her from the boxes had never gone 3 days without bread, and so their opinions were worth precisely nothing. Then she walked on to the rehearsal stage and showed them what she could do. She became one of their most requested performers within a year. She was not naive about what men saw when they watched her. She was not unaware of the whispers, the offers, the notes sent backstage with too much money attached. She read every note. She returned every offer. She was polite, and she was final, and she went home to Edmund each night with her dignity entirely intact. The dignity, she had decided, was not negotiable. Meanwhile, on the other side of London, in the offices and drawing-rooms and parliamentary chambers that she would never enter, again, Alexander Stirling was becoming what the world had decided a duke should be. He expanded the Ravenshaw estate through 2 careful land acquisitions in the north. He made speeches in the House of Lords that were discussed the following morning in Every Gentleman's Club in Mayfair. He cultivated alliances with the precision of a man who has decided that influence is the only intimacy worth having. He was invited everywhere. He was respected by men who feared him and courted by families with marriageable daughters who understood that his coldness was a challenge. And not a wall. He did not marry. He did not love. He escorted women to dinners and balls and the theatre, and he was always impeccable and always unreachable. And the women who tried to find something warmer underneath the Duke of Ravenshaw eventually stopped trying and found men who required less effort. Society had decided he would eventually choose Lady Beatrice Randolph. Beatrice was everything a duchess was expected to be: blonde, graceful, composed, impeccably connected, and too intelligent to make the mistake of seeming to pursue him. She appeared at the same events. She conversed brilliantly. She never leaned in too close or stayed too long. Alexander felt nothing. Not nothing in the way of a man who has not found the right woman. Nothing in the way of a man who has carefully emptied himself of the faculty required for feeling, because the last time he had permitted that faculty to operate, he had been left holding a crushed silk ribbon in an empty room. It was Sebastian Pembroke who finally dragged him to the Royal Adelphi Music Hall. "You need air," Sebastian said. "You need something other than parliamentary ledgers and the kind of dinner where men argue about drainage bills." William had agreed with his easy smile. Alexander had gone because the alternative was another evening alone with his own thoughts, and his thoughts were not currently pleasant company. He sat in the private box. He watched the stage. He waited to feel nothing, as was his custom. Then the music changed. Then the spotlight found a woman in a crimson gown, and everything he had spent 7 years building to protect himself cracked down the center like old stone. The carriage arrived at Ravenshaw House at 8 in the morning, when the autumn mist was still thick over the lawns, and the great gates had only recently been opened for the day. Edmund had his face pressed against the window for the entire final mile of the journey. "Is that it?" he asked. The third time a building appeared through the trees that was larger than anything he had seen in Southwark. "That is it," Pauline said. She did not look. She kept her eyes on her hands folded in her lap, her fingers laced tight enough that the knuckles showed. She had not slept in the carriage. She had sat upright in the dark, listening to Edmund's breathing even out into sleep, and told herself over and over that she was not frightened, that she had survived worse than grand houses, that she had danced before rooms full of men and kept her spine straight, and a house was only a building, and these people were only people. She told herself this until the gates appeared, and then she looked up. Ravenshaw House rose out of the mist exactly as she remembered it. Marble, columns, long symmetrical wings, the Winter Gardens glass glittering at the eastern end. The portraits of the dead dukes would be inside, still watching the corridors. The music room would smell of wood polish and old paper. The library would have the particular silence of a room that remembers too many conversations. Edmund pressed his palm flat against the window glass and breathed out slowly. "It looks like a palace from a story," he said. To Pauline, it looked like a mouth. Alexander handed them both down from the carriage himself. He was watching Edmund with an expression he had not yet learned to discipline, a mixture of wonder and grief, and something that might, in a different man, have been called hunger. He was working something out, 7 years of absence colliding with the reality of a son who came up to his shoulder and had his eyes, and spoke with a vocabulary that suggested Pauline had educated the boy in whatever hours remained after keeping him alive. He introduced Edmund to the household in the entrance hall. He did not hesitate. He did not use careful language. He said, "This is my son, Edmund, and he will be treated accordingly." The silence that followed was of a particular quality that Pauline recognized. The silence of a room full of people who are deciding simultaneously how to arrange their faces. Mrs. Thornton, the housekeeper, recovered first. She curtsied and said she would see the young master's rooms prepared. The footmen behind her took their cue. Order reasserted itself around the fact, as smoothly as water closes over a stone. But not everyone was smooth. Lady Margaret Stirling appeared at the top of the staircase. She was 63, and the years had not diminished her. She wore black still, though her husband had been dead for 7 years. Her gaze travelled from Alexander to Edmund to Pauline, and in that journey her face went through several expressions that she brought firmly to heel before any of them completed themselves. She descended the staircase with the careful, deliberate pace of a woman taking time to think. At the bottom, she looked at Edmund directly. Edmund looked back at her with his clear grey eyes and said, "Good morning." Something moved across Lady Margaret's face that was too complex to name. "Good morning," she said. She did not speak to Pauline. She moved past them into the drawing room, and the door closed with a quiet, definitive sound of a woman who requires time alone to reckon with her choices. Violet appeared from the upper gallery a minute later, and Violet, generous, quick-hearted Violet, came down the stairs and embraced Pauline before Pauline had quite prepared herself for it. "Oh," Violet said, simply, against her shoulder. "Oh, Pauline." It was the first time in 7 years that someone from that world had spoken her name, with kindness, and it hit her somewhere unprotected. She held Violet briefly, and then stepped back and composed herself, because Edmund was watching. He was given rooms with a view of the lawns, and they were larger than the entire lodging they had shared in Southwark, and Edmund stood in the middle of them and turned in a slow circle with an expression that was equal parts amazement and discomfort. "Mama," he said quietly, when they were alone, "why do the servants look at you strangely?" Pauline sat down on the edge of the bed and looked at her son with absolute honesty. "Because they do not know what to make of me yet." "Is it because of the music hall?" "In part," Edmund considered this. He was 7 3/4, and he had grown up in rooms where words were used precisely because they mattered. "They did not see you the way I see you," he said. "They only saw the stage part." Pauline pulled him close and pressed her lips to his hair. "No," she said, "they did not." The first week was an exercise in endurance. Pauline moved through the house with the same controlled composure she had worn on the stage. Chin, level, expression settled, eyes ahead. She heard the whispers the way she heard distant music. Present, unavoidable, but not something she chose to engage with. The music hall woman, the dancer, the old scandal. A trap, some of them said. A clever woman who had produced a convenient air at a convenient moment. She did not defend herself. She had learned that defending oneself in these rooms only confirmed the accusation. Archibald Warren watched her from across every room they shared. He was unchanged, silver-haired, quietly dressed, his face arranged in the same permanent expression of measured pleasantness. But she saw his eyes, and his eyes were not pleasant. They were calculating. He greeted her correctly. He said nothing improper. He was, by every visible measure, gracious. But she saw him watching Edmund with the particular attention of a man reassessing a problem he thought he had already solved. Lady Beatrice Randolph arrived on the fifth day. Pauline had been prepared to dislike her. It would have been reasonable. Beatrice was everything Pauline was not in the eyes of this world. Titled, wealthy, unscandalized, the proper candidate for the position Pauline occupied no man's land beside. But Beatrice Randolph was not cruel. She was observant in the way that some very intelligent women become observant when they have spent their lives in rooms where they are underestimated. She watched. She said little when little was warranted. And when she did speak, she said the precise thing. On the third day of her visit, she found Pauline alone in the morning room. She sat down across from her with the comfortable ease of a woman who does not require a social purpose to justify her presence. "I have been watching Lord Stirling," Beatrice said after a moment. Pauline looked up from her embroidery. "He does not look at you with contempt," Beatrice continued. "I want to be clear about that, because I think you may have decided he does. He looks at you the way a man looks at something he has lost and found again, and does not yet know what to do with." "Lady Beatrice, I am not speaking as a rival," Beatrice said simply. "I am speaking as a woman who would find it deeply uncomfortable to marry a man whose heart is entirely occupied elsewhere." She paused. "Has he asked you why you left? He believes he already knows why. Then he is wrong." Beatrice stood. "And eventually, if he is the man I believe him to be, he will figure that out. But it may take someone pointing him in the correct direction." She left the room. Pauline sat with her embroidery in her lap and felt something shift in the architecture of her certainty. Alexander, meanwhile, was discovering that proximity was a different country than absence. He had spent 7 years with Pauline, reduced to a memory he had deliberately distorted, faithless, ungrateful, bought. The memory was manageable. The memory kept its distance. Pauline herself, moving through the rooms of Ravenshaw House with that careful, dignified composure, was not manageable and did not keep her distance, because Edmund required them to exist in the same space. They discussed Edmund's tutors over breakfast. They passed each other in the corridor. They sat at opposite ends of the long dining table and maintained correct, civil conversation in the way of two people who have an enormous amount to say to each other and are both refusing to say it. He noticed when she had not eaten. He noticed when she had been crying. She was very good at concealing it, but her eyes had a particular quality after, a brightness that was not happiness. He noticed how Edmund watched her, with the devoted, uncomplicated certainty of a child who has never doubted a single day in his life that he was loved completely. That, more than anything, was beginning to undo him. One evening, 11 days after their arrival, when Edmund had been put to bed and the house had quieted, Pauline returned to her chamber and closed the door and did not know what to do with the silence. She opened her traveling case. She took out the crimson gown. Not because she meant to perform for anyone, not because she thought anyone was watching. She put it on because it was the one thing she owned that had been built entirely from her own survival. Every stitch in it represented a night she had kept Edmund fed and herself intact. It was armor of a different kind. She stood in the center of the room and began to move. The music existed only in her memory, but memory was enough. She danced slowly, privately, for no one, working through the grief that 7 years had deposited in her muscles and had never found a proper way out. She danced because Ravenshaw House remembered her as the girl who had been warned, threatened, and removed, and she needed to remind herself that she had become something they had not accounted for. She did not hear the door. She became aware of him by the warmth of presence, that same awareness she had always had, the particular atmospheric change of a room that contained Alexander Stirling. She turned her head. He was standing in the half-open doorway. He had come to check on Edmund, she realized. Edmund's room was next to hers, connected through a shared corridor. He had seen the light under her door. He was not moving. He was watching her with an expression she had not seen on his face in 7 years. All of his composure gone, his careful architecture dismantled, something raw and unguarded looking out from behind the gray eyes. This time, He was not seeing a performer, he was seeing her, all of her. The grief in the movement, the defiance in the posture, the years of endurance written in every turn, the love she had never stopped carrying for a man who had, she had believed, stopped carrying it for. Her, she did not stop, she let him see it. Her breath was steady, her eyes were on his. The silence between them was enormous and alive, with everything they had not said to each other in 7 years. He took a step forward. She took a breath. Something hovered between them, warm and dangerous and old and new all at once. And for one suspended moment, it seemed as though the space between them would simply close by some force larger than either of them. Then, Alexander stopped. He pressed a hand against the doorframe. His jaw tightened. He took a slow, deliberate breath. "Forgive me," he said quietly. "I should not have." He stepped back. The door closed. Pauline stood alone in the room, with the candlelight trembling around her, and pressed her hand over her heart, as if she were holding something inside, it that was trying to escape. In the corridor, Archibald Warren stepped back from the shadows where he had been standing. He had seen Alexander's face at the door. He had seen precisely what it meant. And he understood, with the cold precision of a man who has managed problems for decades, that Pauline Hawthorne had become dangerous again. Archibald moved quietly, as he always had. A word here in the servants' hall, a suggestion there over port to a trusted guest, a gentle expression of concern about Edmund's parentage, framed as worry rather than accusation. He was too experienced to make open attacks. Open attacks could be countered. Suggestions were another matter. Suggestions spread like ink in water. The house grew colder toward Pauline in small, hard-to-trace ways. The best seat in the morning room was already occupied when she arrived. Her requests to the kitchen came back slightly wrong. Guests addressed her with a fractional less warmth than they had shown the week before. Edmund noticed he was 7, but he was not unobservant. "They don't like you more lately," he told Pauline one evening, with the brutal accuracy of a child who has not yet learned to soften such observations. "What changed?" "Nothing changed," Pauline said. "Some people need more time." Edmund looked unconvinced. He was right to be unconvinced. On a Thursday afternoon, the older boys were given a fencing demonstration in the east courtyard. Edmund had been placed with a tutor named Mr. Arthur Sinclair, a capable young man who was patient with questions and genuinely pleased to discover how quickly his pupil learned. The lesson had been going well. Then the wooden practice blade splintered. It was not dramatic. A fault in the grain of the wood, the kind of thing that happens without intention and without malice. But the splinter caught Edmund's forearm and opened a cut that bled enough to make the tutor go pale. Edmund's sharp cry cut through the courtyard. Pauline was in the winter garden, 20 feet away through the glass, and she heard it the way mothers hear their children through walls and sleep and noise, instantly, completely dropping everything she was holding before the sound had finished. She was through the side door and across the courtyard in seconds. Alexander arrived at the same moment from the opposite direction. They arrived together at their son's side. Edmund was sitting on the stone bench with his arm extended, looking at the cut with the measured expression of a child who is deciding whether or not the situation merits tears and has concluded that it does not, but has also noticed that the adults around him seem to think it does. "It hurts," he reported. "But I don't think it's terrible." Pauline's hands were shaking. She pressed her handkerchief against the cut and held it there with steady pressure that cost her considerably more than it appeared to. Alexander crouched beside Edmund and examined the wound with quick, calm attention. "He's right," Alexander said. "It's clean. He'll need the doctor to close it, but he'll be fine." Pauline let out a breath. It shook on the way out. Alexander looked at her. Something crossed his face, not pity. Something more careful than pity. Recognition, perhaps, of what it cost a woman who had kept her composure through everything to nearly lose it now, over a child who was, in fact, perfectly well. Edmund was carried inside with considerable ceremony. He bore it with tolerant dignity, and the doctor arrived within the hour and pronounced the cut minor and easily treated. Edmund was given a small dose of laudanum for the pain and fell asleep in his enormous new bed with his bandaged arm, arranged neatly on top of the covers and his face entirely peaceful. Pauline sat in the chair beside his bed. Alexander sat on the opposite side. The room was quiet except for Edmund's breathing. They had not been alone together like this, still, without the buffer of conversation or other people, since she had arrived. Alexander rested his forearms on his knees and looked at Edmund's sleeping face for a long time. Then, without looking at Pauline, he said, "John Holloway." The name landed in the room like a stone. Pauline looked at him. "Archibald told me," Alexander said, his voice entirely level. "He said you had known Holloway before, that you chose him, that the money was not forced on you." He paused. "He gave me a note. It was signed with your name." "There was no John Holloway," Pauline said. Alexander was quiet. "There was no other man," she said. "There was no choice. There was a threat, and an envelope, and a warning about what happens to women who stay where powerful men have decided they are not wanted." She heard his breath change. "Tell me," he said. So she told him. She told him about the evening she had come to find him, the night she meant to tell him about the child. She told him about the corridor and the open door and his father's voice and the words that had landed like a verdict. She told him about standing at the top of the east staircase afterward, fighting nausea and grief in equal measure. She told him about Archibald's appearance from the shadow of the hall and the small study and the conversation that had been polite and calm and threatening, in the way that very controlled men are threatening when they want you to understand there are no good choices available. She told him that she had not taken the money because she wanted to leave. She had taken it because Archibald had made clear in his reasonable, measured voice that staying would put the child at risk, that the machinery of the Stirling estate would move against her, that she had no legal standing, no family, no protection, and that women in her position had found this out to their great cost before her. She told him she had gone to a lodging house in Southwark. She told him Edmund had been born in October, in a room with a leaking ceiling, by candlelight, without anyone beside her but a midwife she had found through a neighbor. She told him she had worked as a seamstress until her fingers bled. She told him about the supper room. She told him about the music hall, not as a confession but as fact. Edmund needed bread. Edmund needed medicine. I was not ashamed. I am not ashamed now. She told him she had danced before rooms full of men who believed they were watching a performance. They were not. They were watching a woman survive. When she stopped speaking, the room was absolutely silent. Alexander had not moved. He was staring at his son's sleeping face, and something in the line of his profile was very wrong. The jaw too set, the brow too tight, the look of a man who is holding something in that has no safe way to come out. "You should have trusted me," he said finally. The words were quiet. They were not an accusation. They sounded, even as he said them, like a question. Pauline answered it as a question. "Trust is a difficult thing," she said. "When you are carrying a child alone and have just heard the man who promised to protect you fail to speak your name in your defense. Silence. He told his father they would speak of it later," she said. That was not enough. Not for what came after. Alexander pressed his hand flat against his thigh. She could see his fingers tighten. "I was going to fight him," Alexander said. "I needed one night. I was going to tell him the following morning that I would not be managed in this matter. I did not know that." "No." His voice was barely audible. "You did not." Neither of them spoke for a moment. Then Alexander rose. He went to the door. He turned back, briefly, and his expression in that moment was the most unguarded she had seen from him since the Winter Garden 7 years ago. "Do not leave this house," he said. It was not an order. It was something else, closer to a plea than he would probably have wanted it to sound. He left. The following morning, he sent word to every person of consequence in the house. The family solicitors, the estate trustees, Lady Violet, Lady Beatrice, Sebastian Pembroke, William Lockwood, and Lady Margaret, who received the summons in her private sitting room and went very still when she read it. They assembled in the formal drawing room at noon. Archibald arrived last, precisely on time, wearing his habitual expression of attentive pleasantness. Alexander stood at the head of the room. He looked like a duke, all the full weight of the title in his posture, his expression, his stillness. The kind of stillness that precedes something. He placed the forged note on the table. He said, "This letter was presented to me 7 years ago as written by Miss Pauline Hawthorne, explaining her departure from this house. I should like to examine it now with proper witnesses." Archibald's pleasantness did not flicker. "Of course," he said. "I recall the letter. It was distressing, but clear." "Its dates," Beatrice said from her chair, her voice conversational, "are incorrect." She had been studying the note since Alexander placed it down, and she looked up now with the particular calm of a woman who has done her research. "The letter is dated the 14th. The old Duke died on the 13th. If Miss Hawthorne wrote this letter after hearing the news of his death, the date should be the 14th at earliest. But the letter references speaking with Lord Stirling that morning. Lord Stirling was with his father's body from midnight on the 13th until dawn the following day. He was not available for a morning conversation on the 14th. A silence. "A small error," Archibald said. "For a woman of Miss Hawthorne's education and precision," Beatrice said pleasantly, "a rather large one." Violet spoke from across the room. "Pauline did not know any actor named John Holloway. I would have known. I knew all of Pauline's acquaintances. She had no such connection. A maid named Mrs. Elsie Goodwin, who had served in the house for 20 years, and who had been asked to attend by Alexander with a directness that suggested she understood what would happen if she refused, stepped forward and said quietly that she had seen Mr. Warren outside Miss Hawthorne's room on the night in question, very late, and had assumed it was estate business. Lady Margaret sat in her chair through all of this, with her hands folded and her face the color of old ivory." Alexander turned to his mother. "You knew," he said. It was not a question. Lady Margaret's posture did not change. But her eyes, when she raised them, were old and tired, and something else. Something Pauline, watching from the edge of the room, recognized as the exhaustion of a woman who has been carrying a guilty decision for 7 years. "I suspected," Lady Margaret said, "that Mr. Warren intended to manage the situation. I chose not to ask the details." "You chose not to know," Alexander said. Lady Margaret closed her eyes briefly. When she opened them, she looked at Pauline. It was the first time, in all the days since Pauline's return, that Lady Margaret had looked at her directly. She did not apologize. But the look itself, long, honest, without deflection, was something, not enough, but something. Alexander turned back to Archibald. The room was very quiet. Archibald tried, briefly, to salvage the situation with the reasonable composure that had served him for 30 years. He said he had acted in the family's interest. He said a woman without rank or family in that position was always going to create difficulty. He said the child could have been anyone's. "Enough," Alexander said, one word. The temperature in the room dropped. "You stole 7 years," Alexander said. "Not from me alone. From my son. From a woman who had done nothing to deserve what you arranged for her. You will leave this house today. You will leave this family's service today. Any matter of legal consequence will be addressed by the new solicitors I intend to appoint before the week is out. You are finished in this house. Mr. Warren, you may go." Archibald Warren stood. His composure was intact. It was by now all he had left. He left the room. He did not return. Ravenshaw House prepared for a ball 3 weeks later. The chandeliers were dressed with fresh candles. The musicians arrived from London and tuned their instruments in the long gallery. Flowers were arranged in the entrance hall and the ballroom. White roses and hothouse lilies, filling the rooms with a fragrance that competed pleasantly with beeswax polish and wood smoke. Silk gowns whispered across the marble floors as guests arrived through the great front doors. Society had come, curious, appetized, dressed in its very best, and hungry for something to discuss over breakfast the following morning. The invitation had gone out under the Duke of Ravenshaw's crest, and its phrasing had been precise in the way that Alexander Stirling's communications were always precise, including nothing he did not intend to include, and omitting nothing he wished to be understood by implication. Everyone believed they were attending an engagement announcement. Lady Beatrice Randolph moved through the ballroom in deep blue silk and received compliments with the measured grace of a woman who is not surprised by them. She had arrived that morning and had gone directly to Alexander's study, where they had spoken for 40 minutes alone, and when she emerged, her expression was composed and entirely readable to anyone who knew her. She had said what needed to be said, heard what needed to be heard, and made a decision she was at peace with. Pauline stood in her chamber and looked at her reflection in the mirror. She was wearing the dress Violet had insisted on, not the crimson gown from the music hall, a new one, deep blue-green silk, the color of sea glass, made by the Ravenshaw house, seamstress, under instructions from Violet, who had the taste of a woman who understood what clothes were for beyond. Decoration. The gown covered Pauline's shoulders properly. It fit her beautifully. It was dignified. She looked, she thought, like a woman who belonged. She was not certain she felt like one yet. Edmund appeared at the connecting door. He was wearing a new suit, and regarding it with the expression of a boy who has decided to tolerate it, but wants his opinion noted. "You look excellent," Pauline told him. "So do you," he said. Then, in the direct way he had, "Are you afraid?" Pauline considered lying. "A little," she said. Edmund came to stand beside her at the mirror. He looked at their reflections together. His grey eyes, her dark ones, the same chin on both of them from different angles. "I'll stand next to you," he said, "if you want." Pauline put her arm around her son's shoulders and held him briefly, carefully, so as not to disturb the suit. "You always have," she said. They descended the staircase together. The ballroom announced them, before they were properly inside it, that the particular shift in noise that a room makes when it has identified something worth looking at. Heads turned. Conversations paused. The music continued. Pauline kept her chin level and her eyes ahead. She heard it under the music, the whispers. They had not gone away simply because Archibald had been removed. They were the kind of whispers that had existed for centuries in rooms like this. One, the slow metabolism of class judgment, the quiet machinery of who belonged and who had been permitted to visit. She had survived worse. She moved into the room with her son's warmth beside her and her own spine straight, and she greeted the people who addressed her with quiet courtesy. And she did not flinch when she caught the glances that were not meant for her to see. Then Alexander appeared. He came from the far end of the ballroom, moving through the crowd with the unhurried certainty of a man in his own house. He was in black evening coat and white cravat, the small diamond pin at his lapel catching the light, his silver-headed cane at his side. He looked precisely as he always looked in public, contained, authoritative, the Duke of Ravenshaw, except that he was looking at Pauline, and he was not looking at her the way a duke looks at a problem. He was looking at her the way he had looked at her in the winter garden 7 years ago, with his glove removed and his bare hand warm against her wrist, as if she were the only honest thing in a room built on appearances. The crowd quieted around him as he approached. It always did. He stopped in front of her. He looked at Edmund first. Something moved across his face. Pride, grief, a fierce, complicated love that was still learning its own shape. And he inclined his head to his son with a seriousness that Edmund received with equal gravity. Then he looked at Pauline. He offered her his hand. She placed her hand in his. The room went very still. Alexander turned to face the ballroom. The music had stopped, not because he had called for it to stop, but because musicians, like everyone else in that room, understood that something was happening. He spoke clearly, in the same even, carrying voice with which he had addressed parliamentary chambers and estate gatherings and men who had tried to intimidate him for 30 years. "I have brought you together this evening," he said, "for a purpose I intend to make plain." The silence was absolute. 7 years ago, a woman was threatened out of this house. She was given money under coercion, and a lie was planted in her place. A lie designed to make a good woman appear faithless, and to make a man already weakened by grief accept a wound he would never have accepted otherwise. A murmur moved through the crowd. "That woman is Pauline Hawthorne," Alexander said. "She was the companion to my sister, and she was a woman I loved, and when she most needed protecting, I failed to protect her. She left this house carrying my son, and she spent 7 years in circumstances this room has never known and never had to know, because men like us arrange it, so that women like her have no place to appeal." The ballroom was the quietest Pauline had ever heard a room full of people be. She was looking at Alexander's profile, at the absolute steadiness of his jaw, at the hands that held hers without trembling, and she felt something in the center of her chest move. A slow, enormous shift, like stone coming free of stone. "She worked to keep my son alive," Alexander continued. "She preserved her dignity in circumstances designed to strip it. She raised a boy who, at 7 years of age, stood between a duke and his mother, and defended her, because he knew, as I should have known, that she was worth defending." He turned to look at the assembled guests, the faces he recognized, the names he knew, the families whose approval had structured the world he lived in. "The boy is my son," he said. "His name is Edmund Sterling. He will be recognized as such in every legal and social manner available to me, beginning today." Pauline heard someone draw a sharp breath somewhere in the room. She could not identify it. She was concentrating on breathing steadily, on not letting her hands shake, on staying upright in a moment that felt like being unmade and remade simultaneously. Alexander looked at her. His gray eyes held hers. And in front of 300 people, who had come expecting a conventional announcement in a conventional ballroom on a conventional English autumn evening, the Duke of Ravenshaw went very slightly, very quietly off script in the way that men who have spent a lifetime being entirely contained sometimes do when they have run out of reasons for it. "I wronged you," he said, speaking only to her now, regardless of who was listening. "I believed a lie that I should have questioned. I chose pride over inquiry, and I wore bitterness like a virtue, because the alternative was admitting that I had lost the one thing in my life I had chosen for myself." He paused. "You did not fall from grace, Pauline. You were pushed, and then you were blamed for landing." Pauline's breath was entirely unsteady now. She did not look away. "I am asking you," Alexander said, "to become Duchess of Ravenshaw. Not because the title repairs anything, not because it is the correct arrangement, but because there is no version of my remaining years in which I can look at what you have survived and what you have built and fail to stand beside you for the rest of them." The room was a held breath. Pauline did not answer immediately. She had thought about this. She had not allowed herself to think about it directly. Too dangerous, too old a longing. But somewhere in the weeks since their return to Ravenshaw House in the space between Edmund's breathing and the sound of her own thoughts. She had been reckoning with it. She looked at Alexander for a long moment. "I will never again be hidden," she said quietly. "I will never be a shameful secret in a corridor, or a woman introduced last at the foot of the table, or a person whose name is lowered to a whisper when the wrong people walk in." "No," Alexander said, "you will not." "And I will need time," she said. "Trust is not rebuilt in an evening, in a ballroom, before an audience." "I know." Then she stopped. She steadied herself. She felt Edmund at her side, straight and still, watching both of them with the focused attention of a child who understands that something enormous is being decided. "Then yes," she said. The breath that moved through the ballroom was not applause. It was something quieter and more complex than applause, the sound of 300 people recalibrating. Beatrice Randolph, from her position near the fireplace, looked at Alexander with the clear, settled gaze of a woman who has made a right decision and is certain of it. She raised her glass the smallest degree in a private gesture that was not for anyone else to read. Alexander raised Pauline's hand and pressed his lips to her fingers, there in the center of the ballroom, with every eye in the room watching. She felt the warmth of it in her bones. Later, much later, when the guests had eventually remembered how to make conversation again, and the music had returned, and the champagne had been redistributed, and the enormous social machinery of Ravenshaw House had absorbed even this extraordinary evening into its rhythms, Alexander and Pauline slipped away. They walked through the house to the winter garden. Edmund had fallen asleep an hour earlier, in a chair beside the fireplace in the yellow sitting room, his new suit rumpled, his bandaged arm curled against his chest, his face entirely peaceful. A footman had been stationed nearby. He was safe and he was sleeping, and the rest of the world could wait. The winter garden was dark and cool, and full of the smell of roses. Moonlight came through the glass in long silver panels, laying itself across the stone paths and the rose beds and the bench where Pauline had stood on a January morning 7 years ago, and felt his bare hand warm against her wrist for the first time. She sat on that bench now. Alexander sat beside her. For a moment neither of them spoke. Outside the glass the lawns were dark and the night was clear. Inside, roses bloomed in their heated rows, insensible to season or scandal. "Can you love me again?" Alexander said finally, "without fear." Pauline was quiet for a moment. "I never stopped," she said. That was the difficulty. It would have been considerably easier if I had. She looked at her hands in her lap. But love and trust are not the same muscle. One of them spent 7 years intact. The other will need rebuilding. "I know," he said. "I am not asking for instant forgiveness. I am asking for the chance to be the person I told you I was going to be." She turned to look at him. In the moonlight, with the roses around them, and the house full of sound behind the glass, he looked like the man she had first loved. Not younger, not unmarked by the years, but present in a way he had not been since the last time they were in this garden together, present and unguarded and asking. "You have it," she said. He reached across and covered her hand with his. She turned her hand over and held his. The glass around them held the winter out and kept the roses alive, the same as it always had. Then a small sound. They both looked toward the doorway. Edmund stood there in his rumpled suit, stockinged feet, one hand on the doorframe, blinking sleep from his gray eyes. "I woke up," he announced, with the directness of a child who considers this explanation sufficient. He looked between them. "Are we a family now?" Alexander looked at Pauline. Pauline looked at Edmund. She felt Alexander squeeze her hand gently, with the particular pressure of a man who has decided something, and is deciding never to undecide it. "We always were," Alexander said. Edmund considered this. "I thought so," he said. He yawned comprehensively. "May I sit here for a bit, or should I go back to the chair?" "Come here," Pauline said. He padded across the stone path and settled between them on the bench, with the boneless ease of a very sleepy child, leaning his head against his mother's arm and reaching out instinctively to grab a fistful of his father's coat sleeve, the way he might grab a rope, not in fear, but for the certainty of it. Alexander looked down at his son's hand. Something moved across his face that was too large for the features of a man who had spent 7 years convincing himself he felt nothing. He put his arm around his son's shoulders. Pauline leaned her head against Alexander's arm. The roses breathed around them in the still, heated air. Outside the glass, London went on in its enormous, indifferent way. Inside, in the winter garden of Ravenshaw House, beneath the cold moonlight and the warm lamplight, a family sat together for the first time. They did not speak. They did not need to. Pauline Hawthorne had danced beneath gaslight for men who saw only the surface of survival. She had walked through rooms that tried to diminish her. She had given birth alone and raised a son alone, and loved a man she believed had been taken from her, and she had done all of it without surrendering the thing they most wanted her to surrender. Her dignity, her truth, herself. She was not beneath the gaslight now. She was in the winter garden of Ravenshaw House, with roses alive around her and her son warm against her side. And the man she had loved for 7 years, holding them both, his arm around them like a promise finally kept. The Duke of Ravenshaw had lost control the night he saw her dancing before other men. It turned out that losing control was the only true thing he had done in 7 years, and she was glad. If this story moved you even a little, please like this video, subscribe to this channel, and share it with someone who loves a good romance. And drop a comment telling me where in the world you are watching from. I read every single one. Thank you for staying until the end. It means everything.